meters away. I start to shiver.
Come on, Jen. You're cold. Let's get out of here.
I close my eyes and Carl Green's head appears before me. The contents of his skull leeching out onto a nice clean black and white floor. I'm gonna kill him, I say. I'm gonna kill him with my bare hands. And the thing about Anson is, he doesn't have to ask me whom I mean. Just lets his hand fall from my elbow and says, kind of soft and yet so hard and straight as a steel rail,
"You don't have to kill him, Jen. You have me for that."
8.
Now we are spurting out past the narrows, White Wake trailing from behind us, aboard some boat that Anson magically unmoored from a dark, rotten dock not far from where the ocean liners fill with coal and stores. The rain's blown out. The moon bursts free. The draft freezes my cheeks. He's wrapped me in some kind of blanket, pulled from beneath the seat behind me, but that doesn't stop the shivering, which derives from a source far beneath my skin.
"Are you all right?"
he asks at last, over the noise of the motor.
"Course I am."
"You're still shivering."
"It's a cold night."
He says something under his breath and starts to maneuver his coat from his shoulders, switching the wheel from one hand to another.
"Don't bother," I say. "You'll freeze to death in this draft."
"So will you."
"So I'll find another blanket. You just stay put and keep us on top of the water, all right?"
He exhales and nods over his shoulder.
"Under the seats, with the life belts."
I bend down on my shaky knees and poke around underneath the seats until I find a stack of wool plaid blankets identical to the one I'm already wearing. The boat pitches violently. I sprawl on the slatted wooden deck.
"Sorry," calls Anson. "Keep hold, crossing awake."
Another wild pitch, and another. I brace myself against a seat until the jolting settles back into what I suppose is the ordinary rhythm of a small, sleek motorboat skimming across a calm sea. Not that I've ever had the pleasure. My stomach lurches in time to the swell. I set my hands on the edge of the hull and lever myself up, clutching the blanket under my arm. And then I stagger back to where Anson steers the thing, one hand on the chromium wheel and one hand on some kind of throttle, like he was born to do such things.
"Sorry," he says again.
"You're all right?"
"You might have warned me."
"If I'd seen it in time, I would have. You weren't hurt, were you?"
I unfold the blanket and lift it over my shoulders, atop the first one. "I'll live."
"Seasick."
"Now, why would you ask a thing like that?"
"Because I don't want to see your dinner all over my clean deck."
"Don't worry. No dinner here. Just a ham sandwich and a dry martini." He doesn't answer. The boat skips happily along the black water, while the moon strikes a silver path before us. Nearby, a few dark spots suggest other ships, and I guess if I look hard enough, I can distinguish their shapes by the meager light of the night sky. But I don't want to look. I stare dumbly ahead, listening to the drone of the engine, smelling the brine and the gasoline exhaust. Trying not to think, trying not to blink, because each time I close my eyes, I see Carl Green's head spilling onto the floor. His blood the color of wine, brains the color of jelly.
"How much further?"
I sort of choke.
"Far enough. You should sit down. Just sit down and hold on to something."
I sink into the passenger's chair, made of oiled, salt-stained leather. The sea ahead disappears from sight, hidden by the long wooden bow. I watch the glimmer of moon on the polished wood, hear myself asking whose boat this is. He answers me with some kind of reluctance.
"My father's."
"Does he know we're borrowing it?"
"He won't care if that's what you're asking."
"And just why does your father keep a motorboat tied up on the Hudson River?"
"He doesn't. I brought it in myself."
"From where?"
"From where we're going."
"Which is..."
"Don't ask so many questions, Jen. I'm just doing what I have to do. Once I realized we had a leak..."
"Millie!"
He pauses. "No, not her. I'll explain later." No, I want you to explain now.
Anson heaves a sigh so deep, I imagine I can hear it above the noise of the motor and the water slapping our sides. I turn my gaze to his fingers, gloved in leather, wrapped around the throttle, and the moonlit hairs at his wrist. My stomach falls and falls. He pulls on the throttle, and the entire boat seems to rear up like a damn stallion, and I thought we were going fast before, but now we're racing, tearing across all that black water. I clutch at the side of the boat and find a handle right there, just for the purpose of keeping your body anchored to the seat. They think of everything, rich people. I clutch this thin metal bar with one hand and the blankets with the other. My eyes sting. The tears stream out across my temples. I think, wouldn't it be lovely just to race and race along the track of the moon? Anson silent by my side, wind freezing my lungs, salt spray dashing like needles into my cheeks. Race on forever. No shore in sight. Inevitably, the boat slows, makes a long, graceful curve to the right. Anson's hand eases the throttle to a low putter, and the great thrust below my feet dies away into a kind of drifting.
What are those lights ahead of us? The shore?
No, he says. That's Rum Row.
Rum Row?
He reaches for my arm and pulls me gently to my feet, points all the way to the right and then across our front, in a long arc, all the way to the left. An endless string of lights, like somebody's hosting a midnight party in a giant garden.
Ships, he says, anchored 6 miles out from shore, where the legal jurisdiction of the United States ends. They're full of liquor, Miss Kelly, like floating warehouses. You and I, in our motorboat, if we wanted a case or two of genuine Scotch whiskey, we'd sail out to meet one of those ships and shout up for what we wanted. And they'd sell it to us, and we'd hurry back to shore before the Coast Guard could catch us.
You don't say. As easy as that.
More or less, depending on the state of the weather. Of course, most of the boats taking advantage of this service are bigger fry than a man and a woman searching for a drink. The New York rackets, the gangs who keep the clubs and the speakeasies running.
And my stepfather, where does he fit in?
I suppose you might say that Duke Kelly's organization finds itself in something of a competition with the ships of Rum Row. Imported liquor against the native variety. But New York's so thirsty it doesn't really matter. There's room for everyone, you might say. If nobody decides to get greedy. Everybody sticks to their territory.
I stare out at the string of twinkling lights. What an innocent beauty. What a fairy show. This line of ships... How far north does it go?
Up Long Island and Massachusetts, down south along the New Jersey coast, Maryland, Delaware, all the way to Florida, with some breaks in between. Like a sort of blockade, I guess, only the opposite direction. Bringing goods in instead of keeping them out.
Then why doesn't the Bureau just sail out and arrest them?
Can't. It's perfectly legal, what they're doing. International waters. It's the motorboats we try to stop. The Coast Guard does, that is, except we haven't enough boats and men and guns.
We?
He makes a little movement, as if catching himself. Rests one wrist on the top of the wheel. The casing of his watch glints softly by the light of the moon.
Well, which is it? Are you a genuine Bureau agent or not?
Not at present.
Not at present? You quit?
They've hired me. 2 months ago. 2 and a half. Just before Christmas.
I whistle softly. So Millie's right. Hand in the cookie jar, was it? And I thought you were such an honest fellow. What happened? Gambling debt you couldn't convince Papa to cover? His hand moves against the wheel. He curls his fingers around the lacquered wood, making a fist.
No. I guess you might say I was sniffing too close to somebody else's cookie jar. That's what I surmise in any case. I was working on the Kelly racket, as I told you, trying to follow the trail of money. And they called me in the office one morning and told me they had evidence I was taking bribes. Photographic evidence, paper evidence. I remember his face, Shevlin's face,
He's the head of the New York Bureau. I could tell it was killing him. He's a good man, but he had his orders.
I turned to face his profile, lit by the moon.
His orders? Are you trying to tell me this entire affair, my stepfather, are you saying it goes all the way up to the top?
I don't know about the top. Higher than Shevlin, certainly. It seems your stepfather's got a protector of some kind. One prepared to do just about anything to keep his name clear and his bank account fed.
He stands erect, Mr. Anson. His spine so straight as a rail of steel track, so straight as an arrow from Robin Hood's own bow. Shoulders thick and level. One hand fisted around the ship's wheel. Eyes narrowed into the distance. And I imagine that's where I came in, isn't it? You wanted to find out who this protector might be. You cast about. You discovered Duke Kelly's own baby girl lived right there conveniently on your doorstep, right there in Manhattan, just waiting to be plucked up and fashioned into a doll of your own using. Some kind of puppet. Some marionette with her strings all in a heap. You're wrong. Am I? Explain to me, then, how you couldn't just tell me the truth from the beginning. Why you had to put on such a hoax just to get me to play along.
For exactly that reason. You wouldn't have believed me. Even if you did, you wouldn't have thought it worth your while. A slim chance like that, without the Bureau behind me.
Ah, so it isn't worth my while. There's not a thing you really can do to Duke, is there? I'm just the stakes in your little poker match. No, that's not it. I'm the stooge. The dumb stooge holding the bag when...
You're not a stooge, for God's sake. You're not any of those things.
Then what am I? Tell me,
what the hell am I to you, Oliver Anson?
He lifts his right hand and does something to the throttle. I don't know what. Kills the motor entirely. The sudden absence of manufactured noise unnerves me. The slap of water against the hull. He turns in my direction, and his face is all shadowed and bony. His eyes are the same color as the moon, except hotter. I swing to my feet and push my chin up to match his.
Well, when you staked me out, isn't that the word? When you watched me and followed me and made yourself an expert on Ginger Kelly and her squalid little laugh, what was your angle? What were you thinking?
Does it matter?
It surely does.
The boat rocks beneath us, but he doesn't make a grab for anything, just balances there on his two braced feet. Hands down against his sides. I wish I could see his face better. Wish I could divine some clue to this long, silent contemplation he's making. This terrible gaze upon me, with his eyes the shade of the midnight ocean, reflecting the moon.
Well?
I demand. He says softly. I was thinking you were the most extraordinary woman I'd ever known. The boat pitches. Catching some sort of broadside, and I lurch forward straight into Anson's right shoulder, hard too, such that he makes an oof and staggers back, snatching at my back while we tumble together into his seat. The way they do in films, except that instead of kissing him, I sort of trip off his knee and land on my buttocks on the narrow, wet boards of the deck. And it's the last straw, damn it, falling on my buttocks at Anson's feet. Catching glimpse of his horrified, silvery expression above me. I make a sound of rage and rise to my knees. I swing my right fist into the bottom of his iron rib cage and then the left fist. And I reckon it hurts me more than it hurts him, but I don't care. Feels too good. I hit him again and again, and he just lets me swing away, taking those fists to his middle, grasping me gently by the blades of my shoulders as if to support me, in my singular rampage.
All right now, he says, like you might say to a fretful pony, while my swinging slows and stops and I start to list forward into the same belly I've just abused. All right. Deserve that, I guess.
You did. You did. Old Carl.
All right. All right.
Seems I'm crying now, too. Why not? Back shuddering against his firm hands. Soft wool fibers of his overcoat stuck to my cheeks. Now he moves, holding me carefully by the shoulders while he slides down from the seat to the deck beside me and gathers me up whole, just scoops me up and presses me snug into the wide, soft plane of his chest. I ought to keep a belt in you. Would, if I'd had any dinner.
You should. I guess I deserve it.
Opening that door on 10th Avenue, realizing that Millie was right.
I'm sorry.
Gave me my first kiss, Carl Green. Now he's gone because of me.
Wasn't your fault.
All that blood. I want to express more, but the terrible words won't form. The blankets have come undone from my shoulders, but the steady warmth of Anson's arms replaces them. We are just a tangle of blanket and overcoat and great damp bony limbs. Exhausted skin and the punch of two heartbeats.
I found those agents of mine last month, he says. Words hitting me somewhere atop my bare head, stirring the hairs there. When I was keeping watch over you in River Junction. They were in those woods near the cemetery, buried about a foot deep under the snow.
Why didn't you tell me?
I just didn't. He shifts under me. They looked like your friend Carl, you know. Smashed up around the head. They'd buried the two of them face to foot, like a pair of horses in a pasture, shoes still laced. The animals had got to them a bit. That's how I discovered the grave.
The bastard.
It's a bad business, that's all. A terrible business. Maybe I shouldn't have brought you in, but you were the only way, you see. There was no other way inside his racket. No one else he might possibly trust, except someone he already knew. Someone in the family. Someone who might yet have a reason to dislike the man. Someone with brains and spirit. Who else but you? So I had to see it through. I couldn't let myself be swayed by...
By what?
By sentiment, he says softly. The air's dark down here. The moon safe over the ridge of the bow. My head lies comfortably against the lapels of Anson's overcoat. My legs nest into the hollow betwixt the two of his. The boat bobs helplessly, a half mile or so away. A line of floating warehouses lies in anchor, bow to stern, packed to the rafters with any kind of hooch you care to drink. An industry, a city almost, constructed with elaborate human ingenuity in order to circumvent human law. What chance have we got against all that? The two of us, draped upon each other at the bottom of a single motorboat, atop the wide, cold black sea.
Why do you do it? I whisper. People are going to drink that salt. People are going to get fried, whatever the government does. What's the use?
Because it's the law, he answers. I wait for him to continue, but he doesn't.
That's all he has to say.
I consider all the questions I ought to ask him, the outrage I ought to feel. But instead I find myself overcome by something else, something softer. Pity. Not for Anson himself, but for the entire world. This whole rotten state of human affairs. First war, and now this. You can't win anymore. You can't get ahead. You shouldn't even try. I told myself it would be all right, Anson says. I made a bargain with myself that if I kept you from harm, kept the closest possible watch over you, then it didn't matter that I was deceiving you, that the ends were noble enough.
And I wasn't, I guess, noble enough.
That's not true. You're the noblest part of this whole business, Miss Kelly. The only one of us worth the trouble.
I lift my head from his chest and squint at the top of his nose. The trouble of what?
Redeeming. He says the word without the customary irony, calm and reverent, like he actually believes in such things.
And what if I don't want redemption? Saints never do have any fun, it seems to me. Never know any earthly joy.
That depends on what you mean by joy, doesn't it?
I lift myself a little more, so my face is next to his,
and my breath and his breath curled together in the darkness. I don't know. What do you mean by joy, Mr. Anson?
He makes a little noise in his throat. I place my bare hand on his cheek. The skin is warm and springy beneath my palm. A little scratchy, if I care to stroke my fingers against the wedge of his jaw. Strange how I can feel his skin, while I can't quite see his face. I run my thumb along the seams until I find the corner of his mouth. The blankets have fallen away from my shoulders. The boat sways around us. The stars wobble on high.
"Here's what I think, Mr. Anson," I whisper. "I think that if you're lucky enough not to get your head bashed in by some lunatic bootlegger, lucky enough to survive another day in this brute modern world, lucky enough to be sitting inside the measure of somebody's warm arms at the bottom of a boat where nobody can find you, where you're safe from harm for just one moment at the end of a terrible day." Anson leaps to his feet. Jin goes kerplop against the deck.
"Stay down,"
he shouts, and the motor growls to life. And that's when I realize there's another sound buzzing in, another motor drawing near. And as the boat rears up and shoots across the water, the air explodes into pop, 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 the wicked noise of a Chicago typewriter beating hell out of somebody near.
9.
Of course, I've got no intention of obeying Anson's command. I climb on my hands and knees and start to rise up, and his hand comes down on the center of my back and presses me in place.
I said, "Stay down."
The motorboat starts to bank into a turn. I sink down low where he can't reach me and crawl to the back of the cockpit, or whatever you call it, and prop myself up on the seat behind Anson's, just sort of poke my head over the parapet while the boat skips crazily beneath me and the unseen chopper spits out its rapid pop, 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 like a mouthful of nails. At first, I can't see anything on that dark water except the faint glimmer of the lights on shore bobbing up and down against the horizon of the boat's stern as we tear the sea apart. And then I recognize that the particular flash of one particular light represents the pop-pop-pop firing of that Thompson submachine gun, and that it weaves back and forth across the phosphorescence of our wake, nimble as a water bug, droning like a skeeter.
"Who is it?"
I scream over my shoulder. Anson doesn't answer. I guess he's too busy steering this beast of ours through the night air. The noise of the engine builds and builds. The deck slants at an unnerving angle. The force of our speed presses against my skin, weighing down my arms and legs as I creep back upward to the front of the cockpit, anchoring myself on the seats.
"Where's your gun?"
"What? Your gun? Just get down, Jin!"
He must have a holster, right? Surely no special agent of the Bureau of Internal Revenue, present or former, goes anywhere without some kind of insurance policy underwritten by the likes of Smith and Wesson, and especially not to a place like this, crawling with bootleggers and gangsters and pirates of every stripe. I run my hands up under his overcoat, ignoring his shouts of outrage, find the edge of his jacket, and reach up under that.
"Jin!"
Superfine waistcoat, buttons, abdomen twisting away from my touch.
"Hold still, will you?
For God's sake, get down."
"Aha! There it is."
I slide gun from leather, work the object back down under jacket and overcoat and into the open air. Anson makes an angry noise, takes one hand off the wheel to make a grab for the gun, but that kind of maneuver's easily avoided if you've been reared up in the company of three hillbilly brothers like I have. I turn about and take a second or two to weigh the revolver in my two hands. A .38 special, and I hope to God it's loaded. And I stagger back down to my previous post and aim the gun over the edge of the cockpit. Now, as you no doubt recollect, my stepfather don't hoe with guns, not even the kind you used to stalk down a deer in the woods or shoot a plump new bird from the sky. He never did enjoy a spell of hunting like the rest of the River Junction menfolk.
He professed a love for animals and a state of nature, you see, and the thought of spoiling all that noble fur and keen muscle by the unjust advantage of human machine made him sick to his stomach. He did begrudgingly consent to the raising of dumb livestock, which he butchered himself with a long, sharp knife. But he would not hunt an animal in the wild, not ever. Not beast, nor fowl, nor even fish. And not once did he allow the barrel of a gun to invade the threshold of his house and his land beyond it. But my brothers now, my brothers found themselves more susceptible to the allure of a bolt-action rifle, or a long-barreled shotgun, or a short, loud pistol. Around the kitchen table, they did nod their heads wisely, while Duke held forth on the abomination of shooting God's creatures. But in the woods with their friends, why, they showed no such tender scruples. And before I left for the convent, I knew the smooth texture of a rifle stock beneath my arm, and the calm that settles over you as your finger caresses the curve of the trigger. Not that I especially enjoyed hunting for prey. I shot at made-up targets in the wood, or at objects launched in the air for that purpose, not any living thing. But because of the sensation of power a gun conferred upon me. I might be a weak female, born wanting the heft and muscle and timber of a man, but I surely could kill him if I needed to. I surely had the advantage over a fellow, if I had a gun and he did not. If I had the resolve to aim the barrel and press the trigger before he had the opportunity to touch me. I haven't felt the shape of a gun in my two hands for many summers, but it's the kind of thing you never quite forget. Once done, always remembered. I don't bother to check that Anson's revolver is loaded. I could tell by its weight that it is. Just close one eye and settle my soul on that dancing, erratic flash before me. And then, when I find the rhythm of the motorboat's thrust, sense the pause in its motion before it plunges back down, I do squeeze that trigger in the loving embrace of my right index finger. Gun fires. Bang! Kicks back like an angry child. Shout comes out across the water and the pop, pop, pop stops dead. The flash winks out. I call back over my shoulder. Think I got him. Anson swears. The boat starts a sudden turn to the right, banking so hard that I teeter sideways and collapse on the other seat. Hey, what's the big idea? Didn't I just shoot the bastard for you? Anson swears again. And the word is so uncharacteristic of him that I actually turn and look out past the bow. And that's when I hear a shout out over the water and perceive the regular flashing of a large, determined lamp. The boom of an official gun. The motorboat slows in defeat. And while I am no expert in these affairs, I reckon I know the arm of the law when it clasps me to its chest. And unless God Almighty now descends from the sky to intervene, the jig is right enough up. 10. Obedient to the orders of the United States Coast Guard officer calling us through a wooden cone, we fall under the lee of the gray painted cutter and await further instruction. "Should I ditch the gun?" I whisper to Anson. He fiddles with wheel and throttle. Maneuvers us close. "Give it to me," he says, and I hand the revolver to him behind his back. He tucks it into the pocket of his overcoat and hails the deck of the cutter in a voice that knows no master.
"Special Agent Marshall, Bureau of Internal Revenue, in pursuit of known subject."
"Marshall," I whisper. Anson replies with a dig to my ribs.
"By whose authority?" somebody replies. "My own, damn it."
There is a brief silence. I have the impression of profound professional annoyance, like when a girl from the tapping pool in the commercial loans department takes it upon herself to point out some error made by the tapping pool in the investment banking department under such public circumstances that nobody can pretend it didn't happen. A slight commotion ensues. Somebody shouts down a maritime instruction, Greek to me, and Anson brings the motorboat to rest right next to the painted steel hull of the Coast Guard boat. Blood goes whoosh in my veins. Nerves sing out under the premonition of trouble.
"What in the hell are you doing?" I whisper.
We could outrun them in this thing, I'll bet.
And they'll be searching for us all night, and all the next day.
But now they'll arrest us for certain.
Just let me do the talking, all right? Don't say a damn word.
He must mean it, or he wouldn't have added that telltale damn.
A regular blossom and garden of profanities this evening, our Anson.
I clam up and cross my hands behind my back, try not to shiver in the sharp air. The blankets lie in a heap at my feet, like an abandoned nest. Once warm, and for an instant, I ache all over, most especially in the kisser.
Marshall,
what kind of game's he playing now?
A series of metallic bangs strikes my ear as a rope ladder uncurls against the cutter's hull. A moment later, a pair of legs descends along that ladder, topped by a dark coat and an officer's hat. The legs spring deftly from the bottom of the ladder into our snug little motorboat cockpit, and somebody shines down a flashlight from above, revealing a dark mustache attached to a middle-aged face. Not best pleased.
A revenue agent, you say? Where's your badge?
Right here, sir. To my great amazement, Anson unbuttons his overcoat without hesitation and reaches inside his jacket, hands the officer a piece of paper.
Marshall, you say?
Yes, sir. Oliver Marshall, New York Bureau.
The officer motions to me.
Who's this?
Civilian deputy. She's been assisting me with an investigation.
Name?
Can't reveal that, sir. I'm afraid you'll have to appeal to the Bureau. And if everything's in order, we'd like to return to our pursuit, although I suspect our man has already got away.
The officer's gaze shifts from me to Anson's badge, to Anson's face, to me again, sharp and kind of narrow, in the manner of a predatory bird. You know the look, says dryly.
Seemed to me as if you were the one being pursued, agent,
Anson replies in kind.
As you may have noticed, sir, the fellow happened to be in possession of a Thompson submachine gun, with which he proceeded to fire upon us. My colleague had just returned fire and struck the gunman.
That was her?
Yes, sir. She's an expert marksman.
Well, the night is full of surprises.
I dig my fingernails into my palms and knit my lips firmly together, just like Sister Esmeralda taught me to do when my mouth threatens to get the better of me.
I assure you, says Anson, this woman is one of the Bureau's most trusted and valuable associates. I can think of no other partner I would rather have by my side on a dirty night like this.
The officer frowns. The old moon's disappeared, gone behind a cloud or something, and the cutter's light is harsh on the ridge of his brow. He holds his balance on the small bobbin deck without thought or effort, leather hands still clutching the Bureau badge of Anson's.
Look, Anson says, it's been a hard night, and we've already lost our man. I've got to get back to port and make my report. And boy, am I going to get hauled over the coals for this one.
You should have let us know you were carrying out an operation in these waters. It's our watch out here.
I'm sorry about that. Began in spontaneous pursuit and turned into a damned ambush. I'm just sick to death of these fellows slipping through our fingers, that's all.
He says this so sincerely, so brimful of professional dejection, I almost believe him myself. The officer glances back at me, and I assume an air of identical, world-weary regret.
"You really did shoot that bootlegger from a racing speedboat?" he asks.
"I surely did, sir, on the first try. Learned how to aim a gun from my brothers at the western side of Maryland."
He shakes his head and hands the badge back to Anson. His fingers find the buttons of his thick woolen overcoat.
"Shame on you, Marshall," he says, taking off that rich garment and laying it over my shoulders. "Letting a lady shiver like this without thinking to offer her your coat. What the hell kind of gentleman are you?"
"I've often wondered that myself," I say demurely.
The officer steps back to the rope ladder and places his hands on the rungs. Moon comes out again, touching his cap as he turns his head over his shoulder, chin just edged against the cutter's hull.
"Carry on then, Marshall. Sorry for any inconvenience."
11.
You never told me you were an expert marksman, Anson says, as we shoot out over the water, away from the twinkling lights of Rum Row and the diminishing shadow of the Coast Guard. I thought you already knew everything about me.
Not everything. Not a thing like that.
Well, now you know. Where are we headed, anyway? Back to New York?
That depends on what you mean by New York.
I mean the city, of course.
Then no. We're not going back to the city. City's too hot for us right now. I'm taking you somewhere safe.
Oh, brother, I say.
Long Island again.
Again? It's a complicated story. I'll tell you sometime. Say, that reminds me. What gives with that badge of yours, taking Billy's name like that?
He doesn't reply.
The motorboat's skimming along a fair clip, headed for the glimmering shore of Long Island. Rum Row parked to our right, and a wave smacks our bottom, sending us airborne for a second or two. We land with a hard bump, and Anson grunts.
You all right? I ask.
Fine.
He grips the wheel and lifts the throttle a bit more, and I start to wonder just how much juice we have left in the can, racing along like this, gulping down gasoline in such a reckless fashion. The geography of Long Island is gray to me, but I guess we're some distance to the east, hurtling toward shore at an acute sort of angle. Anson shows no hesitation in his navigation, no veering whatsoever from our course. He tilts forward as if that might somehow increase our speed, as if by narrowing his eyes and clenching his stomach, say, he might propel our slim, aggressive craft into safe harbor.
Safe harbor? Some cottage on Long Island? Except this time, when I imagine a cottage like that, snug inside the walls of somebody's grand estate, or else tucked into the lee of some fishing village, some farm, some anything. I don't feel that ache in my chest as I felt in Glen Cove. I feel something else. Some kind of warmth. Some kind of lightening of the blood. I stuff my fingers into the pockets of my Coast Guard overcoat and listen to the thud of my heartbeat against the rip of the engine, and a rare somnolence settles over me. Like on that terrible day when I ran across the wet grass from the old fishing hole and boarded the next train out of River Junction, and no sooner did I fall into the clasp of that ungentle seat and experience the surge and the thrust of a steam locomotive bearing me to safety. Then I went to sleep. I slept right the way to Baltimore, and a conductor had to wake me up so I might not miss the connection in New York. And I remember how, for an instant upon waking, I did not know where I was. I could not have said my own name, only that I was bound for Manhattan. I was fixing to plunge myself straight into the bosom of the wicked city and never come out again. That was all I knew. The horrors of the hour before, why, they had buried themselves, as I slept, under the kind of rich, foot-thick cushion of unconscious thought that would do any psychiatrist proud. And it's the same thing now. That sharpness that overcomes your mind in moments of peril, the perfect acuity that guides your ideas and your actions when your life's at stake. It just wears away as we race for safety on the Long Island shore, slides from my skin like an old coat. The horror of the previous hour replaced by something that is nothing at all. 12. Anson wakes me when we reach land, or maybe the land wakes me all on its own. I open my eyes to the change in rhythm of the engine, the boat maneuvering into some kind of port. Sky still black and cold, moon somewhere behind us. Man beside me says, "Welcome back." I uncurl my stiff body from its strange position and try to summon back the shades of memory. A blanket slides from my chest. "Welcome back to what?"
"You've been out cold."
"Since when?"
"Since about 3 minutes after we parted company with the Coast Guard."
"Coast Guard. Of course. Big boat. Small ginger. Fear like a bucket of ice emptying on your chest. And something else. Something so terrible you can't even think about it just now. You need to think about present needs. Just this one moment you're living now, or else you'll never make it. Black night.
strapping warm fellow leaping from boat to dock, carrying a rope.
Anson.
I place my hand on the hull's edge and push myself upright. He secures the rope to a piling and holds out his hand, gloved in leather. The strength of his grasp startles me.
"Watch the edge," he says low and rumbly,
and I suffer my legs to leap.
"Where are we?"
I ask, marveling at the solid way about the boards beneath my feet.
"Southampton, New York."
"And what's in Southampton, New York?"
"A place I know where we can lie low for a bit until I've figured out our next move."
He's working a knot into the rope, and there's something a little wrong with his movement, something I can't quite pin down. He finishes and turns to me.
"Don't worry. You'll be safe here. I know the owners."
"Oh, brother.
What do you mean?"
"Nothing. And these owners, they won't mind our tramping through the gardens at midnight."
Anson consults his watch.
"It's only 10 o'clock, as a matter of fact, and no, she won't mind."
"She? Me, I presume?"
The woman's voice shoots through the darkness from the edge of the dock, causing us both to jump. Anson's left hand catches my elbow, and again I'm struck by the strange notion that something's gone wrong in the regular operation of his knobs and spindles. Something's not quite right. But the notion's overcome by the sight of the woman now striding up the dock toward us like a bizarre moonlit ghost, dressed in a white bedgown trimmed by long, downy feathers.
"Hello, mother,"
Anson says, calm and clear as you please, just before he topples straight forward onto the planks. 13.
"Well, I won't bore you with all the details. How, between the two of us, we managed to convey him, protesting at every step, to what Mrs. Anson calls the pool house. How she lifts the receiver of the telephone inside the foyer of said building and asks the operator for a doctor somebody, exhibiting all the urgency of a woman making appointment with her decorator, while I unwrap the overcoat, which I now perceive to be badly torn under the left sleeve, from her son's body. How I discover a neat charcoal gray suit jacket wet with blood. How he mumbles at me not to make such a fuss. How I swear and yell that I'll make all the damn fuss I want. How I run for the kitchen and fill a bowl with hot water and return to find the two of them, mother and son, locked in some kind of low, intense argument, from which Mrs. Anson extracts herself with the observation that her son appears to be in excellent hands, and she'll just head for the drive and wait for the doctor, so the fellow doesn't come barging right into the big house and wake up all the staff. Oh, of course, I mutter, unsticking Anson's bloody shirt from his bloody skin. For God's sake, don't wake the staff. Would you stop flinching, please?
She's right about that, however. Can't have anyone talking.
Lord Almighty, like to bled to death, and your own mama can't think but for the gossip.
Not because of gossip, because of our safety. And I'm not bleeding to death, bullet just grazed my ribs, that's all.
How do you know?
I already checked.
Sure enough, a thoroughly red handkerchief falls free as I unwrap the last of his clothing. I set the gory thing aside. Mrs. Anson can spare a dime or two for new upholstery, I do reckon, and fish the cloth from the bowl of warm water.
Poor Jen, he says softly. I expect you've seen enough blood for one evening.
Think nothing of it. I was reared up with a mess of boys. I don't ever faint at the sight of blood.
No, but I'm sorry nonetheless.
Are you actually apologizing to me for getting shot?
For all of it, I guess.
Well, in that case, I say, busying myself with rag and water and skin so it can't form a good look at my eyes. I expect it's a good thing we've got all night.
14. While the doctor attends his patient, I wander outside. Some things ought to be kept private, I believe, and anyway, I could use a mite of air after all that reek of copper blood filling the cavities of my head. To my surprise, I am not alone. The lean, ghostly figure of Mrs. Anson frets about the stonework.
smoking a cigarette. For a moment, I imagine she doesn't notice me. I stand fixed, fingers curling by my sides, while the moon touches her profile and the top of her bare, immaculate head. She exhales a bit of smoke and says, without turning, "How is he?" "All right, I guess, for a fellow missing a chunk of his left side. Bullet went straight between the ribs." "Well, that's a mercy, I suppose," she drawls. Another taste of her cigarette, and then, "You must be one of his colleagues at the Bureau." I hesitate only an instant. "Yes. How lovely. Do you enjoy your work, Miss Kelly? Miss Kelly, do you enjoy all of this? Running around New York with my son, capturing gangsters and getting shot and all that sort of thing?" "Not particularly. I'm more in the amusement line myself." She laughs harshly. "Are you? A girl after my own heart, then. I suppose I ought to ask you how you got into the enforcement business in that case, but at this hour of the night I frankly don't care. Adventure? No doubt. You young things are all terribly mad for adventure." "Adventure. That's it." She turns at last, and I wish I could see her face properly, because I have some idea that she must be beautiful. She's the kind of woman who carries an air of beauty around her, carefully cultivated, like a waft of rare oil, delicate and chiseled, skin as marble in the moonlight. The smoke trails from the end of her cigarette, and she shakes her precious head and says, "Just like Ollie, first football and now this. Smoke?" I start to decline, but my lips tingle. "Why not?" She pulls a silver case from the pocket of her dressing gown and tosses it to me. "Never have sons, Miss Kelly. They're nothing but trouble. You take the most tender care of those little limbs, and then they go off into the world and spend the rest of their lives trying to break them. Girls find other ways of getting into trouble." "Yes, they do." She watches me fumble with cigarette and match. There's a bit of light glowing from what Anson called the big house, 100 or so yards away. And maybe it's just enough to pick me out, there in the country midnight. Just enough to see me by. She goes on more softly. "I have a daughter, too. Just 2 years old now. I expect she'll prove a great deal of trouble when she's older. But my oldest son went to war and died of the flu, and Ollie seemed determined to get himself killed even more pointlessly. At first I thought he should break his neck on the football field. When he finished Princeton intact, more or less, I thanked God. I'm sorry, did you say Princeton? Yes, he graduated, oh, I suppose it's 4 years ago. And instead of taking a nice safe job in a bank or a place at law school like any sensible boy, he tells me he's going to work for the Prohibition Agency. Can you imagine? My son, enforcing temperance, the irony." She laughs again. "He was in Florida first, chasing all those fellows running rum from Nassau, and then they sent him back to New York. And there isn't a day, Miss Kelly, not a day or a night, I don't worry about him turning up on my doorstep, dripping blood from some wound or another. Of course, I never expected him to bring a woman home with him." I've been drifting in bemusement, smoking fiercely ever since the word Princeton crossed those elegant lips, delivered in an accent that reminds me of the Bryn Mawr girls, mouths all stuffed with marbles. The sharpness of her last sentence yanks me back to the present. "Why not?" I ask. "Because he's such a monk, you know. Tommy, he squired about every deb in town. He was in such demand. Darling, charming, golden boy. But Ollie, there never was such a serious child. Even worse since Tommy died. He worshipped Tommy, of course, but the two of them couldn't have been more unlike. Ollie couldn't stand parties. All those girls in white dresses, they threw themselves at him, of course. Girls adore all that dark tragedy. But he never paid them the slightest attention. Never brought anyone home, that is. First football consumed him. And now this." She drops the end of her cigarette into an urn of some kind. "Listen to me. I suppose you're hungry and that sort of thing. I'll make up sandwiches. Cook's gone to bed, poor dear. ham or chicken?
Chicken, I say.
She turns toward the big house and pauses. You know, I believe I rather envy you.
You shouldn't.
No, it's true. I might have liked a little adventure when I was your age. Instead, I got this. She gestures.
And you've got my Ollie.
He's your son. He loves you.
Yes, he's awfully loyal. The kind of boy who would die to protect you, would take anything upon himself to lighten your own burden. But I never quite felt as if we understood each other properly. My fault, I suppose. It's always the mother's fault, isn't it?
That's what the shrinks say.
It's a terrible burden. Poor Ollie. He arrived so soon after Tommy, whom I worshipped. And then there was Billy, who was my last, my baby, until Claire was born. And Billy was so much more, oh, he has a sweetness to him, my Billy, for all his mischief. But Ollie, so quiet and grave and orderly, kept his room neat as a pin, even as a child. You could see he was thinking huge, fierce thoughts behind those eyes. But of course he wouldn't tell you about them. Music, that was what he liked. That was how he told you things.
Plays a fine clarinet.
He plays everything. Piano, trumpet. Used to practice for hours until he discovered football. And I never tried, you see. I never tried hard enough. Tommy and Billy, they were so much easier to love. Now it's your turn to try. Imagine. A sharp chin redhead from... Where are you from, Miss Kelly? You're certainly not one of us.
She says the word us with such a note of strange disgust, I don't take insult. Instead, I say simply, Maryland.
From Maryland. Well, I suppose Ollie wasn't going to fall in love with a debutante.
Take good care of him, please. He really is rather tender on the inside, I believe, though he hates to show it.
She starts to move away toward the house, skirting the dark form of what I believe to be the swimming pool. Her fine pale feathers shiver in the draft like the hair of a Persian cat. I call out after her.
Thank you, Mrs. Anson.
She starts and stops, turns her shapely head to the moon.
Anson?
And maybe I said that on purpose. Maybe I called out the name Anson as a test because I already knew what she would say. Maybe I'm expecting what comes next. The way you expect a wave to crash upon the beach, after watching it build and build to a mighty crest offshore. My stomach is sick. My eyes a little blurred. My head still turning her words over and over, sorting them into some kind of order.
Yes, I say firmly, sort of desperately.
Anson.
And she answers me as if she's been expecting something like this, as if she's playing a part, as if she's been guiding me homeward all along. Voice gentle and sure and terribly, terribly weary.
Anson is Oliver's middle name, Miss Kelly, after the great naval captain. Didn't he tell you? Our family name is Marshall.
15. I stand there, smoking my cigarette outside the pool house for some time. Until the cigarette's finished and the moon drops behind the roof. The door opens. The doctor appears.
Miss Kelly, he says, squinting into the darkness.
Right here.
Ah, I've bandaged him up. Nasty gash he's got. I've given him brandy.
I beg your pardon. Did you say you've given him brandy?
For medicinal purposes, of course, he says in a tone of slight offense. It's perfectly legal, you know.
And he drank it?
Why, yes.
Lord almighty, how much?
4 ounces. He wouldn't take more.
A grieved sigh.
I hope it will help him sleep. A good night's rest is essential. I've left another 8 ounces on the nightstand. He should have another 2 ounces in the morning.
I'll see to it personally, doctor.
And no exertion of any kind, Miss Kelly. We can't have that bandage becoming dislodged. He lost a great deal of blood, a great deal. You may give him another 2 ounces if he becomes restless.
With the greatest pleasure. He seems to be peering at me, underneath the brim of his hat.
I link my hands modestly behind my back.
Yes. Well, rest if you can, Miss Kelly. It may be a long night. You may ring me on the telephone, of course, if there's any change, any difficulty whatsoever.
Of course. He makes a gruff noise in the back of his throat and wishes me good night. I wait until his shadow disappears into the maw of the big house before I straighten away from the giant stone container against which I'm leaning and slip through the doorway into the pool house. I'll say this about the rich. They know how to live. I judge this building is designed for summer entertainment, if the wicker furniture is any indication, to say nothing of the absence of any source of central heat. Large parlor, lined with French doors, white sanitary new kitchen to the side, bathroom of bright clean tile. In contrast, the bedroom's small and made for napping, or possibly something else that has nothing to do with a good night's sleep, containing only an armchair and what I believe they call a daybed, done up in white sheets and a counterpane of blue and white toile. Summery and feminine, and much in contrast to the man who sits stiff beneath that counterpane, propped by pillows, thick chest altogether bare except for the wide, white gauze swathing his ribs. I find myself a hollow next to his left knee. He gazes warily at me. "You could use a shave," I say. He lifts his right hand and touches his jaw. "I apologize," he says, without a hint of irony. "I suppose on an ordinary night you'd have shaved before dinner. A good thick beard like you have. Isn't that right?"
"Usually I do, yes."
"Is there a razor in the bathroom?"
"I expect so, but..."
I rise and fix my stride for said bathroom, and when I return with soap and towel and razor and hot water, the wariness in his navy eyes has transformed into horror. "Don't you worry," I tell him, busying brush into soap. "I have three brothers. I can surely shave a man's chin when I must. And this is a fine new steel safety razor besides. You couldn't cut yourself if you tried. Just you lean back against those pillows, Mr. Anson, and allow me to do the rest." For good measure, I press the tips of my fingers into his right shoulder, and he obeys me, sinks his back against the pillows, and aims his gaze at the ceiling as I swirl suds over the planes of jaw and chin, the shaven soaps of a fine, expensive grade, producing rich lather that smells of bergamot or something. I never was good at perfume. Never could certainly tell the scent of one rare substance from the scent of another. The bedside lamp casts a quiet glow over all that skin, his face and his neck and his beautiful white shoulders. I don't know how he endures the chill like that, without a shiver nor even a goosebump. The air's so heavy and cold, you can almost put out your hand and lift it. "You don't look much like your mother," I observe. "So delicate and pretty as she is."
"Thanks very much."
"You're something else. I don't know what it is. All squares and blocks and dark angles. Did you get that from your father?"
"Not really. My father's fair. Elegant like her."
"So you're a throwback of some kind. Barbarian ancestors. Reckon that's why you liked football so much, isn't it? My brother Johnny's like that. Lives for football." He flinches. I take his chin in my left hand and lift the razor in my right. Commence to stroke his cheek in long, sure movements. "Your mother told me," I say. "Mothers do spill all the beans, don't they? I guess Mama spilled more beans in the past 5 minutes than you've spilled in all these weeks I've known you. How you played football for Princeton, for example, and then joined the agency after graduation. Something to do with your brother's death, I think. Another golden boy. Your brother just like Papa. And you were the dark, silent one. Murder on the football field. Despair of debutantes everywhere. The exact opposite of... what was his name again?"
"Tommy."
"Tommy. I'm awfully sorry about all that. Poor Anson, losing a brother like that. When you was scarce more than a kid yourself, I truly am sorry."
He doesn't say a word. Just stares a hole in the ceiling and endures the way I rasp carefully along the line of his